Zikuni. This way I know I can get out when I have to leave later. Okay, first of all, I'll talk, everyone asked me about America. I'll talk about that at a few words at the very end. But I had a reward going to the States, I guess if you go to Dvar Mitzvah. I learned something I never knew. And it goes back to what we spoke about two shiurim ago, about Mr. Gris. And I learned there's Baruch Hashem, another person alive who can say Eidat Nemana and everything I told you, and he added something I didn't know. And the story is as follows, and I make this addition now, it's retroactive to two shiurim ago. When this property, when Teddy Kolak was pressing Mr. Gris to give the property to David Yelling's Teachers College, and it looked like they won out and they were going to get it, there were plans underway already to build Chorev High School for Girls right next door. The person involved in Chorev High School is no longer alive. Yona will recognize his name, David Weingarten. I believe it was Sharon Tours. Am I correct? That was the name of the firm. And they were an interesting story. They became very well-to-do following the Six-Day War because they're the only travel agent that retained their space on El Al. All the other agents gave it back because they figured the war will last for months and they're holding empty space that they can't pay for. He was the only agent who didn't give it back and had confidence in Israel and a miracle that happened. And Sharon Tours then for a little while had a monopoly on the travel to Israel and they became a very well-to-do agency. He gave a lot of charity to Chorev High School. He died within the last year. It happened when I was at the OU, his son, who's a travel agent, who I know from years ago, he studied Machon Lev, Meir Weingarten, called the OU. So they told Meir that I was sitting there and he wanted to speak with me. And I don't know how he got involved with the story of the building. And he tells me that his father, he said, of course I know the whole story. You did a miracle, etc. But he tells me his father went to Teddy Kolak. When he also had power, you know, this wasn't a small person, it was a person of means who had invested in El Al, had invested in Israel, had invested in Chorev High School, particularly the one for girls, that was his pet project. I think his wife was the one who took the initiative, Shoshana. She was a granddaughter, a great-granddaughter of the Mishpatei Uziel. In other words, he came from Rabbonim, I think it's originally Polish Rabbonim, who were Rabbonim in Belgium, and she was a granddaughter, a great-granddaughter of the Mishpatei Uziel. So she was very active for Chorev High School. So he went to Kolak to plead, how can you give this building away to a secular school? We have a religious high school next door, it's not good. And Kolak got hysterical at him, as Kolak could. Kolak Kolak has many schuyot, don't misunderstand me, but Abulvan, like the Bulvan, if you know what I'm saying, I don't know how to say that in any, I don't even know if the word Bulvan is Yiddish, I don't know what the origin of the word is, but I don't know how to say that in any other language, but a pushtak, like the pushtak. Pushtak nisha pushtak, let me say it in Turkish. Kolak started screaming at him and yelling at him, what are you talking about? What is this, a ghetto? What is this, Meir Sharim? And Levi, he washed the floor with David Weingarten. You have one heck of a lot of nerve. And what's wrong if there's Chorev High School for Girls? And next to it is David Yelling's Teachers College. This isn't Meir Sharim. And David Weingarten walked out very depressed because, after all, it is a terrible factor when you're building here Michlalar and here Chorev High School for Girls. Here you suddenly have a major secular institution. And then a few days later, everything changed, and he knew the story of my meeting with Mr. Gris. So I had only one little small addition that I didn't know, and I found that in the OU office a few days ago. Yes, Chaim. Yeah, and Mr. Gris already had almost agreed. It was almost a fait accompli. No, in other words, the pressure was coming from Teddy Kolak, and David Weingarten knew Teddy Kolak. He didn't know Joe Gris. Got to understand, David Weingarten already lived in Israel part of the year, at least, if not most of the year. And he moved in heavy circles. He commanded influence. He commanded prestige. He commanded money. He became a kablan. He built the building of Rechov HaKharam. I remember when people ask him, how much does an apartment cost in the building you're building? He said, if you have to ask the price, it's not for you. So it gives you an idea. But he knew Kolek. He didn't know Gris. That's why. You understand? And then I knew that it was practically a fait accompli, because when Whitey Herbert called me, he gave me the background and he said to me, it's almost lost. And you have to do something to salvage the situation. And that's, I knew, but I never knew about the meeting between David Weingarten and Teddy Kolek, and also that Mayor Weingarten knew the whole story, what happened afterwards, because his father evidently checked out. What happened? That I went from a fast day to a feast day, and they told him the story of the meeting in the lobby of the King David. Okay. So that's one addition that I didn't know, and I added for the sake of accuracy and for the sake of history, because when all is said and done, it's a fabulous achievement that this whole mountain, this whole tremendous mountain, is dedicated to Torah. And while you sit here today, every sits here today and he thinks to himself, wow, what's the big deal? Yerushalayim is 70% Shomer Shabbos. We're talking the 1960s, the 1970s. If Yerushalayim was 30% Shomer Shabbos, I'm overstating it. You follow me? What you see today is a different story. This is a result of the American Aliyah, the French Aliyah, and as we spoke yesterday about Rav Ovadia Yosef, you can like him politically. Not, I just heard that Yishai interviewed on the radio. I mean, these politicians, they must take for granted that the average mentality, average IQ of the person listening to the radio was 80-80. And could be the average, because they talk, I mean, the guys, I could tell just listening how he's lying through his teeth, you understand? But all right, it doesn't matter. But whether or not you like Rav Ovadia's politics, but he brought back, he Rabbi Elbez, the whole movement of Sephardic pride, and they brought back hundreds of thousands of Sephardic Jews to Shmirat Shabbat. You can't get away from it, and this is a fact. This is a fact. By the way, it happened in the United States. Yona will testify. I can testify. The Sephardic community, when I went to YU, there were a few Sephardim there. So the little bit we knew about the Sephardic community, most of them were Mechalel Shabbos. Most of them were Mechalel Shabbos. They were traditional. In other words, there was no conservative shul, there was no reform shul. But the level of observance was like the level of observance of the second generation of the East Europeans. Take a look today in Flatbush, what's going on. No? Find the Sephardic Jew who will dare be Mechalel Shabbos Beperhesi in Flatbush. It doesn't exist. I mean, this is, you got to give credit, well, like it or not, whether they eat rice on Pesach or not, but they really brought back their people. And as I explained many times, they never lost it. You know my famous example that people always quote, and it's my example, and it's very a very powerful example. I was once at the airport, must have been in the late 70s when I started traveling with Russia, whatever it was, I was at the airport. And a Sefer Torah was being carried through the airport. Either I forget where it was going out. It evidently was coming into Israel. A Sefer Torah. And you could tell it was a Sefer Torah. You know, Elal gives it, if you bring a Sefer Torah, they're machabedet. They do, if they have an empty seat in the plane, they'll put the Sefer Torah on the empty seat. If not, they'll put it b'mokum mechubad. And this person was carrying it. It was an amazing sight. All the Sfadim at the airport surged forward to kiss the Sefer Torah. Two-thirds didn't have anything on their heads. They covered their heads. It was a sight to see, like this. Now, I'm not going into the halacha of covering your head with your hand is considered a kippah. It may very well not be, because it's part of your body. It has to be something else. But some put on a handkerchief. The Ashkenazim, if they wore a kippah, they kissed it. If they didn't wear a kippah, they walked the other way. They didn't know what a Sefer Torah is. Yitzchak Rabin's son knows what a Sefer Torah is. Shimon Peres's, some of his grandchildren know what a Sefer Torah is. Eitan Barak's daughter knows what a Sefer Torah is. Fuad's children, they talk a Sfadim, could be they know. But the Ashkenazim, Yossi what? Yossi Balin's son knows what a Sefer Torah is. Shlomo Aloni's children know what a Sefer Torah is. That's what I was saying. But the Sfadim, even if they're a little bit out of it, but they still know what a Sefer Torah is. So be it as it may, don't confuse Jerusalem of today with Jerusalem of yesterday. Now, then we spoke about literature. And I have to say that most of you fellas, did you get my message, Jack? Most of you fellas, there's no doubt in my mind that, and YU is going through, the YU that you know is not the YU I went to. And I have to tell you, I personally suffer and fear what will become of YU, because if I never dreamt faculty goes without yarmulkes. Well, if faculty goes without yarmulkes, so then of course you can have students without yarmulkes. And now you have students without yarmulkes, and once again they're afraid of the government because they're taking federal funds. Ribbono Shel Olam, what will be left in 50 years? I'm going to talk about that tonight in my hesped for Dr. Liebau. I'm going to talk about how a Jew has to live, what the concept of time is. I'm going to tie it in with Avraham Avinu. But anyway, the YU that you know is not the YU that I know. But anyway, it doesn't matter. What's better? Today, YU? No. No, it's not better. It's not better. That doesn't make it better. You have a bigger yeshiva. You have a high. Show me one Aaron Lichtenstein today. Show me one Gershon Sadowski. But it's not better because you have an atmosphere. We have people without yarmulkes in Yeshiva University on principle, and they're interviewed for the commentator, and they stand their ground. Why they don't wear yarmulkes? In Yeshiva University, you have a JSS taking in students who are not from... What's the whole purpose of JSS? Was Lekarev. But it shows you that Reb Simcha Zussel Breider was right. You see, it shows you. You have to go back in time, go back in the time machine, go back 100 years, go back to Kelm. Reb Simcha Zussel Breider, we're going back 120, 130 years, had a high school. The first yeshiva high school in modern times. And he was a Talmud Mufak of whom? What do you know? Avery. You're studying for Smicha. Who was Reb Simcha Zussel Breider? Talmud Mufak, Reb Yisrael Salanta. Right or wrong? And what is the Talmud's greatest dream? My greatest dream was someday the Rev would visit Israel and come into my classes in BMT. There wasn't Chris yet, but at least see what was going on in BMT, to see what we created here. That was my greatest dream. Reb Simcha Zissel invited Reb Yisrael Salanta to visit Kelm. Reb Yisrael refused. So they asked him, Rebbe, how are you refusing? Reb Simcha Zissel, your greatest Talmud, one of your greatest Talmudim, how can you refuse to visit? And Reb Yisrael said, if I visit the high school, everyone will think I approve of it. I only approve of it as long as Reb Simcha Zissel runs it. If something should happen to him, who knows what can happen afterwards? It become an Avodah Zarah. So I don't want to visit, I don't want to give it my Heksha. And Enochinam, Reb Simcha Zissel died or was incapacitated, he had heart trouble, they abolished the high school because no one else could run it with Yirat Shemayim the way he ran it. So Yeshiva, with Yeshiva University, it began a fabulous idea, but frankly, to me, it's frightening. I never dreamt students in the yeshiva in public walk around without kippot, eat without kippot, refuse to put a kippah on, justify themselves, academic freedom, they don't believe in the halacha the way others do. This one says, I believe in God in my heart, and the administration's afraid to do anything because of the federal funding. So before you know it, you'll have homosexuals camping in and guys with their girlfriends in the West Side crowd, academic freedom. You know, it's a question of time, 10, 20, 30 years, and time moves on. To me, it's very frightening. But the yeshiva I knew was very broad. And of course, the example was the Rav. The Rav, his knowledge, I understand, what he was able to do with mathematics, with physics, with world philosophy, and with literature. And that's what I explained. You can argue from today to tomorrow, are you allowed to study secular studies? You're all familiar with, I'm sure, the Mashal and the Ramah and their exchange of correspondence. And the Mashal, the Ramah tells the Mashal, stop bothering me and stop giving me Musa. It's an old machloket. It goes back to the Rishonim. It goes back to the Gemara. And he says, I choose to study secular studies as well. He says, and I do it at a time that no one else is learning. What's amazing is how the Ramah, you know, I'm talking about the Tshuvah HaRamah, I believe it's Hayyan Vav, where he describes the time that he does it, Shabbos after davening, he says everyone else goes for a walk, I study secular studies. Chalamayd, when everyone is going on picnics and everyone is traveling, I study secular subjects. So it's amazing the time framework he gives. If today we would say a volume like this would come out in English, Lakewood would have to put the Tshuvah HaRamah in Chayrim, that he admits that he studied secular philosophy on Shabbos after the Kugel. Yeah, it's a little bit worse than the Netziv reading Hamelitz Friday night after supper when he could no longer keep his eyes open and study Gemara. Remember when he, you know, I'm talking about my uncle killed in a tziv, and Lakewood put the translation into Chayrim, because the world is going to see what the Netziv did Friday night. Oh, what a world we live. But anyway, the Rav, I'm not here to justify. You can have your own viewpoints. I saw from your comments after class that world literature is distant from you. But what the Rav pulled out of it, how he developed concepts and ideas. And it could be, I once had once heard Rabbi Lichtenstein discuss this, and I've discussed it with him, and it could very well be that you can get it out of Masa, or you can't get it out of Masa. In other words, when all is said and done, what literature can do will bring it to life right before your eyes. And the Rav quotes from that story, New Year's Eve, 1951. I explained to you last week the background of the story, my difficulty in locating it, but the concept of the man who realizes he's finite. And that's the whole question of the individual, the community, and the Rav describing himself in Berlin. It's a beautiful piece. What the Rav means, it's inspiring. I don't have a full answer. In other words, the fact that we're not going to be here 50 years from now, what's inspiring about that? But perhaps it's tragic but inspiring. Perhaps the thought is, I live, I pass it on, I educate my children, my grandchildren, I'm an individual, I'm part of a community. If I'm not here, at least the community continues. It could be this is what he meant. But he didn't explain himself, but the story, the feeling, the emotion is eye-catching. The story with Baron Lichtenstein and Shakespeare is a powerful story. And you had to have been at the funeral to understand what Rav Aaron was saying. And I feel there's a lot of truth to it. With all the concepts of Kavod HaMeit, it could be that the Chevra Kadisha, death be not proud, it could be it would have driven the point home to them a little bit more than the black and white of the Halacha or the black and white of the Masa. I don't know, it's open to debate, but the Rav certainly was influenced by his mother. His mother had a tremendous love of literature. She passed it on to him. His wife had a tremendous love of literature. It's interesting. It ran in the family. And I can tell you, if we mentioned Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik yesterday in class, Rabbi Yeruchim Rav Noach, so I can tell you that in the years when the Rebbetzin drove the Rav in, there was a whole period where she came with the Rav to the yeshiva. She drove him in on Monday afternoon. They left Boston. They drove in. I can still see their Dodge parked outside of the yeshiva. They stayed across the street in his mother's apartment. His mother was a widow. There was room in the apartment right across the street. And so the Rav said, "Shir, what did the Rebbetzin do the next morning? I mean, to shop, you can shop in Boston. You don't have to shop in New York. What did the Rebbetzin do?" Many times she sat in the library. The Gottesman Library was on, it was one floor above where the Rav said she, on the second floor was the Gottesman, I don't know what it is, I think it's the high school library today. But that was the Gottesman Judaic Library, the two separate libraries, Pollock, secular, Gottesman Torah subjects, and she, or Hebrew, Yiddish, etc. And she would sit there reading Yiddish Haskalah literature. And then what would happen, if we were lucky enough, during lunch break, and the Rav had finished shir and she was still reading, or the Rav was yet to start shir and it was before shir, whatever it was, if we were lucky enough to see the sight, Rav Yeruchim Gerelik would walk into the library, and there was the Rebbetzin reading Yehuda Leib Peretz in Yiddish or some other Haskalah literature, and there was Rav Yeruchim Gerelik, and somehow they had a very unique relationship, and the debate began. Gerelik knew the literature inside out. Of course, he never admitted it to his students, but he started debating with the Rebbetzin on this point and that point, and he's a sheikitz, and what he threw out, and a chada'am, and we would see the two of them in the library, you know. This was a sight like a movie for us. The Rebbetzin in dialogue with Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik. This was a sight. They all knew Rabbi Yeruchim was a sheikitz tahor when it came to knowledge beyond. He knew. Rabbi Noach Bornstein didn't. There was a difference. But the one who knew and admitted it and quoted it to refute it was Reb David Lefschitz. You see, Reb Yeruchim would never admit to his students what he really knew, what he really read, what he did in his youth, what he ran around. That he didn't admit. But Reb David Lefschitz, he could quote Hu Dibber Ritkva. He was the only Rebbe who survived to change to English because he knew Hebrew. And enough fellows were going to Israel and coming back knowing Hebrew. And he taka quoted a haram and Bialik, and he quoted it, you understand, and admitted, and he knew it by heart, and he dealt with it. But Rabbi Yeruchim in the Veikla, the Rebbetzin, That was a sight. Halavai, we would have had video cameras then, you understand? Halavai, we could have snuck out. It would be, precious. But it remains in memory. I can't show it to you in a tangible fashion. Now, I come to the high point of today, and it's again an amazing piece. And how the Rav pulls this together from human existence, and how he could draw upon it. See, this was the Rav. This is the Rav creating literature before your eyes. And he's dealing here with a simple problem. No one wants to be forgotten. You see, this is a terrible feeling. A human being is alive, and we're alive, we're functioning, we're doing, we're creating, we're writing, we're thinking, we're famous, we accomplish. And then what happens to the human being? 50 years, 100 years, who remembers them? Who recalls them? Read Sefer, read the book of Kohelet, you understand? There are reasons why we read it on Sukkot, on Shabbos Cholamoed Sukkot. This year was read first day Sukkot, right? I don't know, Chutz Laaretz, what do they do? Also, if Shabbat is the first day, they read it on Shabbat, right? The first day, they don't read it the second day, they read it the first day. Yeah, first day Yom Tov, because it's... Shmini Atzeres, they read Kohelet? No, first day Yom Tov they read it. No, Sukkot. Anyway, here we read it first day Sukkot. It was a tremendous davening. I remember first day Sukkot. I davened more than that. Yeah, we have to look. But I know that here we read it first day. So you read Kohelet. Look how depressing it is. You walk away. I'm here. I'm gone. I'm forgotten. And this is a normal human instinct. People do things. For instance, I give you a very simple example. This summer I visited Washington with grandchildren and we spent a few good days at the Smithsonian Institute. How many of you have been at Smithsonian? So you go to Smithsonian, where do you go? Think for a minute. You start at what they call, I think it's called the castle, whatever that building is called. That's the office building, the central building, to get a map, to get guidance, to watch a video. And what happens there? You walk in, there's a sarcophagus looking at you, right or wrong. You walk in here, you turn to your left. There's Smithsonian. The guy who gave all the money, he died in Italy, he was traveling, in his will, his bones had to be put into a sarcophagus and left at the entrance to the Smithsonian Institute. So everyone walking in, uncorking Mr. Smithsonian 180 years after his death, the guy probably feels like he's still living. You follow me? And this is an intelligent guy. But this is that desire. Look at the paros. Look what they built. And you can go on with thousands upon thousands of examples. Take a look at Ted Williams. Look what went on in America this summer. Do I need a better example? Take a look. Only a Jewish cup. Pardon me. I don't want to sound anti-Semitic, but only a Jew could be smart enough to set up an institute where they, what do they call it? Cybrophonics, whatever the word is. It's a word I never heard before. Cryonics. Cryonics, I think the word is. Where they freeze your body, you pay $100,000, that they're going to bring you back to life when they figure out a cure for why you died. And if you can't afford to pay the full amount, so for 50 grand, I think it is, they freeze just your head. How the heck a head can start come to life again? It's beyond my concept. And this is real. These are people, and they're paying, right or wrong. And Baruch Hashem, Ted Williams could afford already, you know, whatever he wanted, so they froze his whole body. Could you understand this? Rabbeinu Shel Olam. And this was front page news in every newspaper, what went on. His daughter from his first marriage objected. The children from the second marriage said she doesn't love her father, that's why she's objecting. And they brought a little paper he wrote and he signed that was on top of a cigar box, on top of a cigarette package. It defies imagination. The great Ted Williams, look at the difference between my Joe DiMaggio and Boston's Ted Williams. In death, you see it all. So you see, this is normal. And the Rav here tells a story. This was all part of the Tanya Soloveitchik Memorial Lecture. And the theme here is so crucial, because the Rav repeats this many times in many different places. But the Rav tells a story. He was a Rav in Boston. And you can just envision the story. He tells the story. It's the 1930s. It's during the Depression. And this elderly woman is coming to the Rav. And she's counting out her quarters. And she reserved a plaque in the shul, a plaque that the Rev says cost $100 memorial. I doubt if it was $100. You know, he's talking in 1970. Maybe $100 seems too high. I'm only, maybe it was $25, $50, 1934, 1935 money. and the woman is counting out the quarters. And finally, the rabbi, could you imagine, this is the rav, the woman is counting out the quarters, giving the rav the quarters. This is a rabbi, this is what we're talking about, this is the rabbinate. This is why the rav had such empathy for rabbanim, because he knew what the rabbinate was all about. And this is the rav, Mori Urebi, and a woman is counting out quarters, and he has to keep a cheshbon until she pays up the $100 or the $25, and that she will have a plaque after 120 years. And finally, the rav says to her, tell me, my dear lady, do you have money? Do you have savings in the bank? This is the depression. She says, no, I have nothing. So why are you struggling and counting out quarters to give money to the shul? You need it for yourself. She says, Rebbe, you don't understand. My children already are Americanized. Kaddish they won't say. No one will remember me. At least if I have a plaque in the shul, my name will remain on the wall and the shul will say Kaddish and say Yisga for me. And the Rav said, see, this woman represents every man. This woman represents every human being. This is a natural desire. And then the Rav zeroes in on Lyndon B. Johnson. And he says something here so insightful. He quotes, evidently, the Rav said, it was in print, the Rav read the New York Times. He said, when Lyndon Johnson was nominated to be Kennedy's running mate in 1960, people looked at Lyndon Johnson like he was crazy. First of all, he was the head of the Senate. He was the majority leader. You know what it means to be majority leader of the Senate? You know what it means to be a vice president? They say Cheney has more power than any vice president in history. No, who sees what Cheney does? But they say Hitaka has power. But Allah had kama vakama, the average vice president is nothing. He can't open his mouth. There's a president. He's there. A vice president, but no real power, no real task, no real assignments. It's only ceremonial at best, and only subject to the whims and wishes of the president. And they asked Lyndon B. Johnson, you have so much power now. Why are you giving it up? What are you taking this? To run vice president. And Lyndon B. Johnson, brilliant man, outstanding politician, Mr. America, or at least Mr. Texas America, what did he answer? He said, you're absolutely right, but the history books will devote a few more lines to the man who was vice president than the person who was the head of the Senate, the majority leader. You understand? The Rav Mamish quotes him like it's a Rashi. You understand? And the Rav learns Pshat in this. He says, you see, this simple woman is not a simple woman. You can't dismiss her. You can't laugh at her. Lyndon B. Johnson thinks exactly like this woman. He's collecting quarters to put it together in order to build a memorial to himself. And this is every human being. This is natural. This is the way we want to be. This is a natural desire, a natural inclination. Now, what does Judaism have to say about this? Chaim, where is Uri? I just spoke with him this morning. We were just maledicting Russia together. And we punish Shalom. And where is Eli? The new fella, Ostrovsky, just got married. How do we pronounce it? Ozarowski. Where is he? Chazar and Shas. Where is Aaron Beyer? God, the guys are so afraid. The time, the pressure. Okay, nevertheless, where is Yoshua Goodman? On Sunday he's Goodman, on Monday he's Badman? What's going on here? Okay, Avery and Levi. But Levi, you were not here yesterday. You were here? Yeah. Let me see if I have you on the list. Yeah. Okay. So two stars, Levi and Avery. What does Judaism require? The Rav here is fabulous. Tana Rabbanan. No? Who are the rabbis? Give their names. Tana Kama. Tana Batra. Give their names. We have to be anonymous. That ultimately a Jew, a Torah Jew, has to rise above the instinct to occupy center stage. We have a task to do in the world. We have to know how to get off the stage. We have to know what's important. Who were the rabbis? Why did Chazal say Tana Rabbanan? Why didn't they give a whole list? Why didn't Chazal say Tana Kama, who he is? Tana Batra, who he is? Anonymous. Important is their teachings, not who said it. And this is a theme the Rebbe touched upon time and again.